Brethren, we've come to the last service of our convention. We are very thankful that all of our speakers have traveled such long distances to come to stir up our pure minds. Brother Ken and Sister Virginia certainly have come a long way. And Brother Ken, at this time, through his contacts, insights, studies on the natural seed of Israel, and we see in God's plan the spiritual and the natural seed being developed, has chosen to speak to us at this time on the topic, what's happening in Israel? What's happening in Israel? Brother Ken.
Thank you, Brother David. And it's a joy to be at a convention, and especially the beginning of a convention, and it's a little sad to be at the close of a convention. If there was one question that's been asked me most in my fellowship with the brethren, it's been, what's happening in Israel? So we thought we'd talk about what's happening in Israel. You have a handout that is two pages. We'll be referring to it several times during our talk. Also, some of you, 25 of you, were, I don't know if I'll say fortunate enough or not, but purchased this book from the book table, the Israeli-Arab Peace Process in New Brunswick. It's the latest book that New Brunswick has. Israeli-Arab Peace Process and Bible Prophecy. It's the latest booklet that the New Brunswick class has published on Israel. And when you get one, you'll notice it says, An Open Letter from Christians to Christians. We put that there purposely because we know in your zeal and enthusiasm you're going to start handing it out to Jewish people. And it's not meant for Jewish people. It's a witness to the Christians. Evangelical Christians are very excited about what's happening in Israel. And this will give you an opportunity to give a witness to them, to the truth, starting springboarding from Israel. This is not meant for Jewish distribution. We hope to have a similar, parallel type of booklet for the Jews in connection with the Israeli-Arab peace process also, but we don't have it out yet. A few words about the message of comfort that we are giving to the Jewish people. I'm often asked by some brethren, well, why don't you preach Jesus to them as their Messiah and as their Savior? Aren't they supposed to come into the have an opportunity for the high calling as well as anybody else? Well, yes, they are have an opportunity for a high calling. And I firmly believe that the Jews, they have and they will. Perhaps some will come into the high calling yet. But I feel that it will be through the general witness message that is being given that will attract the Jews that the Lord is calling to the high calling. Now, in addition to that general witness message, we have a specific commission in Isaiah 40. Comfort ye, my people. And preaching Christ to the Jewish people is not a message of comfort for the majority of the Jewish people. Well, some of you say, well, why don't you even mention, you know, Jesus as their Messiah and not try to convince them of it in your presentation? We're trying to follow the type of message we're giving, the content of message that Brother Russell gave in his Jewish mass meetings, especially the Hippodrome. And also, I have been impressed by how he has handled the problem or the question of Jesus and presenting Jesus. He's written in the reprints, and I can give the citations to anybody, that if, after his mass meetings, if any would come to him with show deeper interest. You say, ah. Then he would come to him and show deeper interest and ask him about Messiah. He would tell them that your Messiah is a class, a group, and not an individual. And you say, oh my, was Brother Russell that deceptive? Deceptive? That is very accurate scripture. Jesus as an individual is Christ, the Messiah, and Messiah is Christ. Is Christ to us, the church. But it's not Jesus, but it's the Christ, head and body, that is the Messiah to Israel and the world of mankind. And the book of Amos speaks of saviors upon Mount Zion, referring to the Christ, the class that will be Israel's Messiah. So Brother Russell wasn't evasive. He was giving a very scriptural answer to the Jewish people when he says, your Messiah is not an individual, it's a group, it's a class. Most brethren are acquainted with the Hippodrome message of Brother Russell. Everybody knows about that. All Bible students know about that. But not too many Bible students know what happened at the end of the Hippodrome speech. Brother Russell had recently come out with a new booklet entitled Jewish Hopes and Prospects. It was consisted of two parts. One, his recent Jerusalem talk, which was meant for a Christian audience, a Gentile audience. And he dealt with the devil, and he dealt with Jesus as their Messiah, who they not their Messiah, but their Savior, whom they rejected. And because they rejected him, they had the double punishment. And then the second part of that booklet was a reprint of the third volume chapter, The Restoration of Natural Israel. Some more zealous brethren passed that booklet out after the Hippodrome speech. The next morning, there were in the Jewish papers headlines in New York. Pastor Russell has betrayed his trust. Pastor Russell is a missionary. This is in the reprints. Brother Russell apologized in an article in the Jewish press. He said his people were not supposed to have given out this booklet. They were not instructed to give out this booklet. This booklet was not meant for a Jewish audience. It was meant solely for Christians. And a large percentage of the Jewish leaders accepted that. But that haunted Brother Russell's attempt to give a message of comfort to the Jews the rest of his life. After he gave about 5 mass meetings in the United States, he planned a tour of Europe and to visit every center in Europe where there was a large Jewish concentration, every city in Europe where there was a large Jewish concentration. And there was one rabbi in New York that still believed that he was a missionary because of what happened by handing out that booklet. And this rabbi wired ahead to Jewish leaders in each one of these cities where Brother Russell was going to have a mass meeting. And when Brother Russell got up to speak, a small group of Jews stood up and started screaming and shouting and calling him a missionary, and the audience couldn't even hear him. He would sit down, they would sit down and be quiet. He would stand up to speak again, and they would start shouting and drowning him out. And he would have to call the meeting off. This happened city after city after city in Europe. Again, this is in the reprints. You can understand why I'm a little apprehensive about Tuesday night and our first showing in Canada. It is an Orthodox synagogue, and the seating capacity is smaller in an Orthodox synagogue than the conservative synagogue that Ed was in. So I think that perhaps it would be best if not many brethren came out to the showing, and if any do come out, please do not get involved in a detailed discussion with the Jewish people. We don't want to give the impression that we are taking advantage of their gracious hospitality of inviting us to have this showing there. So we'll leave it at that. What's happening in Israel? We're going to deal with the political situation currently, the atmosphere in Israel currently, and then scriptures that deal with not so much the peace process, but the land issue, which the peace process is all about. First, a word about Rabin. I had an hour and a half meeting with Rabin before he became prime minister. And you might wonder why Rabin is making all of these concessions and compromises. Rabin is not a man of faith. He doesn't have an ounce of faith. His mother was very active in the Labor Party. She was known as Bloody Rose. She was a Bolshevik, a complete atheist. And Rabin was raised an atheist. He has no faith. He's very sincere in what he's doing. He feels the only way Israel can survive is by compromise and by getting the backing of the Western powers in the United States. And they're forcing him to compromise because the United States, on the other hand, has to appease who? The oil-rich Arab nations, because we're dependent on 65% of our oil now is from overseas. But Rabin has no faith. One interesting aspect of our interview or meeting with him, and he was very laid back, casual, the two Israelis that I had with me, my interpreter, who those of you who are on the Israel mission, Dov Keenan, you met him. We didn't need an interpreter on that occasion because Rabin spoke in English. But they were amazed at how laid back he was, because he's a very nervous individual, and how long of a meeting we had with him, an hour and a half. We covered so much. And in the process of the meeting, I said to him that I feel on the basis of Bible prophecy that within the next 10 years, 1 to 2 million Jews are going to come back from Russia to Israel. He laughed. He said at the most, 500,000. Well, there's 600,000 there now, and we still got a few years before the 10 years is up. But the interesting thing was, this was before the 92 election, and 2 weeks before the 92 election, his party won, and he came into government. He was giving a campaign speech, and he was dealing with the economic conditions in Israel and the poor economic conditions. He says, if we get elected, he says, we're going to turn the economy around so that Israel will be able to absorb 1 to 2 million Russian Jews in the next 10 years. Now, whether it's just being a good politician or what, I don't know. Now a word about Arafat. Ever since the signing of the peace accords, Arafat has conducted his correspondence on a letterhead that has on the top of it the Office of the President of the State of Palestine. There's not supposed to be a Palestinian state, and certainly they don't have one now. He's not a president, he's a chairman. And that letterhead has a seal on it, the official seal for the State of Palestine. And that seal is a map. And it's a map of not only Gaza and the West Bank, but Israel proper. What is the state of Israel today is a part of this map that he claims is the Palestinian state. And he has the audacity to carry on his correspondence with Rabin, the prime minister of the state of Israel, with this correspondence, with this letterhead. And Rabin is foolish enough to acknowledge this correspondence and conduct correspondence with him, receiving a letterhead from Arafat with Israel being a part of the state of Israel. Again, showing the compromising nature of Rabin. Now, since the signing of the peace accords in 93, September of 93 in Washington, over 130 Israelis have been killed by terrorist attacks, some of them suicide bombers. Arafat claims that he has no control over these terrorists. These aren't members of the PLO. His PLO, he says, these are members of Hamas and the Islamic Jihad. But 2 weeks before the suicide bombing in January near Tel Aviv, Arafat in a speech said, "We are all suicide bombers." And he says he has no control over these suicide bombings. He incites these suicide bombings. A word about the peace process. The peace accords spell out the peace process to be a process, a long process. The first part of that process would be, upon certain agreed upon negotiations, Gaza and parts of the West Bank would be given to Israel, or rather to the Palestinians. For what? They would own the territory? No. They would be able to have self-government on that territory. So what happened when Gaza and Jericho were agreed upon for Palestinian self-government? Did they have sovereignty over the land? No, that land still belongs to Israel. Hopefully Rabin thinks, hopefully from his standpoint, not from my standpoint, that he's going to extend this self-rule to the rest of the West Bank before the middle of 96. But still, the West Bank will not belong to the Palestinians. They will just have the right to have self-rule there. It is not until the middle of 1996 that the issue of the permanent ownership of the land will begin to be negotiated, and the status of the Jewish settlements will begin to be negotiated, and the status of Jerusalem will begin to be negotiated. Now, a little known factor is, you say, well, why did the, Rabin, we can understand why he and Peres are willing to compromise. And there's another aspect to this. Rabin and Peres are dangerous men, because they both want to go down in history as peacemakers. And it's now or never, because they're that old. They're in their 70s. They're not going to get back into office already. And for the next election, they're talking about a successor to Rabin on the labor ticket. They have to do it now if they want to go down in history as peacemakers. And they're trying to do it. They are desperate. They will make any compromise to go down in history. When Gaza was given over to the Palestinians for self-rule, you know, Israel has its popular songs too. And the top hit in Israel was a new song, "Bye Bye Gaza, Good Riddance." The Israelis were happy, delighted to get rid of Gaza, because in that narrow strip of territory, you have 750,000 Arabs. It's a boiling pot. You can't control it. But the next day, they took a poll in Israel, and over 50% of the Israelis said Rabin should cut off any further negotiations with Arafat. They don't trust Arafat, and they're against any further negotiations with Arafat. Now, there have been many violations of the peace accords that Rabin signed with Arafat. Violation number one. In the peace accord, it states that Arafat will have the Palestinians change what is called the PLO Charter. I don't know if you're acquainted with the PLO Charter, but the PLO Charter is the, you know, it states the policy of the PLO organization. And several of those articles state that the mention or declare that the state of Israel has to be destroyed. That's in the PLO Charter. And Rabin's agreement with Arafat was that even before the peace accords were signed, which they were signed in September 93, that the PLO would have to change their charter. They never changed it. They haven't changed it to this day. Also, the peace accords state that once self-rule, Palestinian self-rule is established in Jericho, in Gaza, in the West Bank, that the PLO is going to have to disarm any militants, Palestinian militants, and control terrorism. Terrorism has flared up since the signing. Over 130, as we said, Palestinians have, or rather, Israelis have been killed during by terrorists. So Arafat has violated that part of the peace accords. The peace accords stipulate the number of Palestinian police there would be in Gaza and in Jericho. The Palestinians have 8,000 more police than it was agreed upon. And these police drive around in tanks. We didn't need tanks for it to be a police force, you know. But that's the way it is. Another violation. I could go on down the list of violations. Because of all of these violations, you know, Rabin has a coalition of the weak left-wing parties. There are the right-wing parties, the major one, Likud, that's now being headed up by Bibi, Benjamin Netanyahu, And the right-wing parties have said, because of these violations of the PLO, the violations of the peace accords, that when they come into office, and they hope to come into office after the 96 election, they will roll back the peace accords and the progress that was made in the peace accords. Under no condition will they permit anything but very local autonomy of the Palestinians on the West Bank. Now, as a result of the increased terrorism, Rabin is having a hard time even within his own cabinet. One of his chief negotiators, Deputy Defense Minister Mordechai Gur, had an interview published in one of the major Israeli newspapers. And he said about this, about his negotiations with the PLO leaders and what they see as their final objectives of the peace process. He says, quote, now this is Deputy Defense Minister Gur, member of the Labor Party, one of Rabin's major negotiators with the Palestinians. He says, quote, it's most unpleasant to hear what I hear from the Palestinians. They no longer speak of a house in Hebron or settling on a hill in Ephrat on the West Bank, but they speak of settling on a hill that's where the University of Tel Aviv stands. Right now, they're telling the Israeli negotiators, look, we're not going to stop at the West Bank. We're going to end up with all Israel. Rabin was reporting this to the Knesset, and he told the Knesset that he told his Palestinian negotiators, counterparts, that if he ever told the Knesset what the Palestinian negotiators were telling him in these negotiations, he said the Knesset would stop the negotiations immediately. After the January suicide bombing, in which 22 Israelis were killed, President Weissman, who is a laborite. And the office of president in Israel is a figurehead, ceremonial head. They are not to get involved in political policy. But he went on national broadcast, radio, Israel's main radio, and he pleaded with Rabin to stop the peace process and to get together with the right wing and reevaluate Israel's whole position towards the Palestinians. After this last bombing, in which two American girls, well, one was killed, one was injured, suicide bombing, Rabin had a cabinet meeting. He told them how he was dealing with the matter. He's putting pressure on Arafat to crack down on the terrorists in Gaza. Six members, labor members of Rabin's cabinet, told him, "You're all wrong in your approach. You have to send the Israeli army into Gaza, and you have to wipe out all the terrorist nests in Gaza." So Rabin is getting more and more and more opposition within his own political party and within his own cabinet. Now, there's not only the issue of the West Bank and Gaza. There's the issue of the Golan Heights. Syria is not only unwavering in its demand that Israel must make a complete withdrawal from the Golan Heights, but Syria's position is that after the negotiations, the Syrian-Israeli border is going to be a matter of a few meters from the Sea of Galilee. And Jerry and others of you who have been in Israel, you shudder to think that the Syrian border is going to be right up to the Sea of Galilee. Rabin has already decided with his cabinet, because of the pressure of the United States, that Israel will withdraw completely from the Golan Heights in a three-year period, conditional to the United States putting a peace force on, consisting of the U.S. Army, on the Golan Heights, peacekeeping force. Well, the Republicans are going to have something to say about that. 94 election, you had the sweep in the Congress of Republicans. Jesse Helms is now the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. He says, no way is Congress going to give the finances that would be needed to station U.S. troops on the Golan. The House of Representatives is especially controlled by the extreme right wing. The religious right, if you please. And they say, no way will Congress vote any money to support a U.S. peacekeeping force on the Golan. Cal Haleni, who was a tank commander and the hero of the 73 war on the Golan, with eight other members of the Labor Party in the Knesset, has stated publicly that they will completely oppose Rabin when his policy on the Golan comes up for a vote in the Knesset, and if they oppose it, Rabin's government will topple with a no-confidence vote. Okay, that's enough for atmosphere, I guess, because we want to get into other things. Except to say this. The inevitable has happened. Just this last week, Israeli Arabs want autonomy. You know what an Israeli Arab is? These are Arabs that live in Israel proper, and they have Israeli citizenship. And most of them live in their own villages, Arab villages, and they have an Arab mayor. And the Arab mayor went on radio and says, the Palestinians get self-rule. We demand self-rule right in Israel. Okay, one final thing on the peace process. Well, two final things. I mentioned yesterday that Brother Obi and I went to a dinner in honor of Professor Branover in New York a couple of weeks ago. And the main speaker at that ceremonial dinner was the mayor of Jerusalem, Olmert, who is a Likud member, brilliant man, has a degree in law, a degree in philosophy, a degree in psychology, was a member of the Knesset since the age of 28. He's probably about 38 or 42 now. Branover right away introduced us to him. And in his talk, he said this, in his speech. He says, as mayor of Jerusalem, he says, it's with great grief that I have to report to you that the middle of 96, negotiations are going to start as to the final status of Jerusalem. He says, Rabin had no business putting Jerusalem on the negotiating table. He says, I'm going to tell you a story about Camp David and Prime Minister Menachem Begin and how he refused to have Jerusalem put on the negotiating table. He said, under Jimmy Carter's pressure at Camp David, after President Sadat of Egypt and Begin had come to an agreement, which included not only peace, the terms of peace between Israel and Egypt, but also the agreement that Begin would then further enter into negotiations on self-rule for the Palestinians on the West Bank. They were supposed to leave Camp David for Washington for the ceremonial signing on the White House lawn. 5 minutes before they were supposed to leave, Begin hears a knock on his door. Prime Minister Begin hears a knock on his door. He opens the door and there's Sadat and Jimmy Carter. And he says, Mr. President, come in. Takes him into the living room and he says, have a seat. He says, what do I owe this great honor to? And Jimmy Carter said, well, there's one little point we forgot about during our negotiations. And no, we can just settle this matter in about a couple minutes. And Ruth. Begin's a very suspicious man. He says, and what is this little point? And Carter said, well, he says, it's Jerusalem. Begin says, a little point? And Carter says, well, Mr. Prime Minister, you must be aware of the fact that I have never accepted Jerusalem as the capital of the state of Israel. And Begin says, and Mr. President, if Jerusalem isn't the capital of the state of Israel, what is the capital of the state of Israel? And at that point, Carter was speechless because he couldn't very well say Tel Aviv or it should be or Haifa should be because it would sound ridiculous in that climactic situation. So Begin said, Mr. President Sadat and Mr. President Carter, Jerusalem is, Jerusalem was, and Jerusalem will ever be the capital of the state of Israel. Gentlemen, I have to finish packing. You can sit here as long as you want and discuss the Jerusalem issue. I'm leaving. Goodbye. And that was it. And Mayor Olmert's lament was that Jerusalem should never have been agreed to be put on the negotiating table. But it will be negotiated in 96, along with the final status of the West Bank and Gaza and the final status of the Jewish settlements. We'll have to end our atmosphere and what's happening in Israel now and go into some scriptures. First of all, this map here. It says, find Israel and then you will understand the Israeli-Arab conflict. Well, if you look for Israel, these are all Arab nations here. Actually, there's 22 Arab nations. And where do you find Israel? That little sliver, that little white sliver in here. Surrounded by all of these Arab states who are very militant against Israel. That's why you have a problem in the Middle East. That's why Israel cannot surrender any more territory. And the Israeli intelligence has reported to Rabin that there is not an Arab leader, whether it's the Egyptian president who ostensibly has peace with Israel, or whether it's Arafat, there is not an Arab leader that has the mental disposition of peace towards Israel. All it is a signed paper. And X number of years after this peace agreement, all of the Arabs are going to start a war against Israel. This is the Israeli intelligence telling Rabin this. This is why Israel is very foolish if they give up any land. Now we want to turn to Joel, the second chapter. Or rather, the third chapter, beginning with the first two verses. And behold, in those days, and at that time, when I shall bring again the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem, I will also gather all nations and will bring them down into the valley of Jehoshaphat, and will plead with them there for the people of Israel? No. For my people. And for my heritage, Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations and parted Israel's land? No, parted my land. You know, it grieves me when I hear some brethren say, oh, you know, that this nation of Israel, they're just one of the kingdoms of this world. They're not going to be God's people until the kingdom is set up in Jerusalem. They're not going to be God's land until the kingdom is set up in Jerusalem. What does God say through His people, or through His prophets? Before the kingdom is fully set up, the people of Israel are my people. The land of Israel is my land. And He's gathering the nations down to the valley of Jehoshaphat because of what the nations have done to His people. And because they have partitioned, and this word parted could be just as well translated, they have partitioned my land. All right, let's deal with how they have partitioned the land of Israel and why the Lord is angry. Take the back side of this single-sided map, and you get map number one. This is the land that Britain promised in the Balfour Declaration that would be a homeland for the Jews. This was affirmed, this territory was affirmed by the League of Nations in 1920. And in 1920, Britain was given a mandate to prepare this land for a Jewish nation. When did the partitioning begin? In 1947? No. It began in 1921 and 22. Great Britain, for imperialistic reasons, it was actually Winston Churchill, who was the colonial secretary at that time, lopped off three-quarters of the land promised in the Balfour Declaration, this dark area here. Great Britain lopped off three-quarters of the land promised in the Balfour Declaration and said, oh, this narrower strip, the one-quarter, would be the where the state of Palestine would be formed. And then we pass down to the third map and the UN partition plan. That one-quarter was now to be piecemealed, and an Arab state would be made, another Arab state would be made of the darker portions, and Israel would actually be three little segments in that remaining one quarter that was left by Great Britain in 1922. This was the UN partition plan in 1947. As a result of the War of Independence, Israel accepted that plan. And they declared their independence, and the armies of seven Arab nations marched on Israel, and as a result of that war of independence, Israel gained more land than was promised by the UN, and Israel had this larger portion of white in this map number four. And you have the West Bank that is in the dark color, the same color as Jordan, because Jordan occupied the West Bank and the city of East Jerusalem. Now on your next map, map number five, as a result of the 1967 war, Israel took this whole massive territory, including the whole Sinai Peninsula. And then in their peace agreement with Egypt, Israel agreed to give back the whole Sinai Peninsula. So this was Egypt since the peace agreement, and the West Bank now is not the same color of Jordan, but because the West Bank, as a result of the 67 war, was under Israel's jurisdiction. Now, we feel, and we hope we get into the scriptures on it, that there will be a future war between Israel and the Arabs. And we don't feel in that future war that Israel is going to get back all of the land that is promised to them in Genesis 15. But the scriptures do spell out certain portions of land that they're going to have before the time of trouble is over. They're going to have the Golan Heights. So they give the Golan Heights up, they're going to get it again. They're going to have Gilead on the east bank, Ammon on the east bank, Moab on the east bank, and Edom on the east bank. So Israel actually not only have the West Bank, but will acquire some of the East Bank as a result of another war with the Arabs. Now this map shows the foolishness of permitting a Palestinian state. If there's a Palestinian state, this dark area here is just a 9-mile stretch between the Palestinian state and the Mediterranean Sea. Now, you have heard about Katyusha rockets. They can be smuggled in any place. They are being smuggled in. An IDF report, intelligence report, has, to Rabin, has said that the Palestinians are smuggling in Katyusha rockets right and left. They have no control from stopping them smuggling these in into Gaza. In this dark area here, 70% of Israel's population lives in this dark area. 80% of Israel's infrastructure is in this dark area. This dark area will be very vulnerable to Katyusha rocket attacks if there is ever a Palestinian state. It is because the nations, beginning back in 1922, partitioned God's land, that God is bringing them down into the valley of Jehoshaphat, and he will pour his judgments upon them in that phase of the time of trouble. Now some scriptures on the land that Israel will occupy. We want to turn to Micah, the seventh chapter. Verse 14. Feed thy people with thy rod, the flock of thine inheritance, which dwell solitarily in the wood in the midst of Carmel. Let them feed in Bashan and Gilead as in the days of old. Now, the word feed, the first word in this verse, you probably have a marginal reference, and it gives the word rule. Look it up in your Strong's Concordance, and it means rule. So speaking about rule my people, or rule thy people with thy rod. And the word rod there is the Hebrew word for scepter. So rule thy people with thy scepter. And we do feel that Christ at his return is ruling over the Jewish people and directing their affairs. And verse 14 is a scene that is not after the mediatorial reign begins, but it's a scene during the time of trouble. This verse is sandwiched in between a series of time of trouble verses. Verse 13, what better, what more descriptive account do you have of the time of trouble than verse 13? Notwithstanding the earth, and the Hebrew word is earth, notwithstanding the earth shall be desolate because of them that dwell therein, for the fruit of their doings. The earth is symbolic of society, earth society. And this present evil social order, this present evil world, will become desolate. Why? Because of the fruits, the results of the doings, the evil and corrupt doings of the systems of this present evil social order. Then the verses, I won't take time to read them, from verse 15 onward, are descriptive of the time of trouble. In verse 15 especially, Brother Russell in volume 4, page 556, applies it to the final destruction of the nations in the time of trouble. So sandwiched in these time of trouble, between these time of trouble verses, it speaks of Israel having Bashan and Gilead. What is Bashan? Well, we're not going to turn to it, but I'll give you the citation. You turn to Deuteronomy 3, verses 3 and 4, and Numbers 21, 33 to 35, and Joshua 21 through 21 and 27. Bashan is the Golan Heights. The city of Golan was a major city in Bashan. And we know that the city of Golan was a part of the Golan Heights. So Bashan is the Golan Heights. And Israel will be occupying the Golan Heights before the time of trouble is over. And they're also going to be occupying Gilead. Gilead, you look on your Bible maps, Gilead is the east bank of the Jordan River. Now, we're going to deal with several scriptures that mention Assyria. And you have to identify who Assyria is, as it's used in many of these prophecies in connection with Israel at the end of the age. And I think the most descriptive and the most identifying scripture on who Assyria is in these prophecies in connection with Israel is Micah, the fifth chapter. In verse 4, you have a kingdom scene, and he, Christ, will stand and feed. Again, it's the Hebrew word meaning rule. You have a marginal reference to that effect. And he, Christ, shall stand and rule in the strength of Jehovah, in the majesty of the name of Jehovah his God. And they, Israel, shall abide, for now shall he, Christ, be great unto the ends of the earth. This is obviously a scene during the Mediatorial reign. And then verse 5 starts out by, and this is the man by which, and in literally in the Hebrew, this is the man by which peace shall come. When the Assyrian shall come into our land, and when he shall tread in our palaces, and then shall we raise against him 7 shepherds and 8 principal men, and in the Hebrew it's 8 princes of men, and they shall waste the land of Assyria with the sword, and the land of Nimrod in the entrances thereof. Thus shall he deliver us from the Assyrian when he cometh into our land, and when he treadeth within our borders. And then the result of that war is, and the remnant of Jacob shall be in the midst of many people as a dew from the Lord, as the showers upon the grass that tarrieth not for man, nor waiteth for the sons of men. Yes, Israel will be a blessed nation after the kingdom is set up, after that final invasion in which Israel will be delivered. Well, what invasion do the scriptures describe or portray that takes place just before Israel is delivered, just before the kingdom is set up? Well, the invasion of Gog and Magog. So we feel that Assyria is symbolic in the set of scriptures that we're going to be dealing with of Russia. And you, of course, you're just to fill in a little added details. Remember how Brother Magason suggests in verse 5 that the 7 shepherds are the glorified church, and the 8 princes of men are the ancient worthies. Instead of thy father, they shall be thy children, whom thou wilt make as princes in all the earth. And 8 signifies a new work, a new order. And it will be through the glorified church and the ancient worthies that the Assyrian, symbolic in this prophecy of Russia, Gog of Ezekiel 38, that invades Israel and they will be destroyed by the glorified church and the ancient worthies. Okay, now with this identification of Assyria as Russia, we want to turn to Zechariah, the 10th chapter. And now I'm going to start taking off with my voice and going fast. Verse 9, and I will sow them, that is Israel, among the people, their dispersion, and they shall remember me in far countries, and they shall live with their children and turn again. I will bring them again out of the land of Egypt and gather them out of Assyria, and I will bring them into the land of Gilead and Lebanon, and place shall not be found for them. And he, that is Israel, shall pass through the sea with affliction, and shall smite the waves of the sea in the sea, and all the depths of the river shall dry up, and the pride of the Assyrians shall be brought down, and the scepter of Egypt shall depart away. Now here's such a massive exodus from the nations at the end of the age, out of especially Egypt and Assyria, that the land of Gilead, the East Bank, and Lebanon, we feel southern Lebanon, will be filled with Jews because of such a massive exodus from Egypt and Assyria. Well, are Egypt and Assyria literals or symbolic here? Well, there's about 400 Jews in Egypt and about 400 Jews in Iraq, which is modern Assyria. How can 800 Jews fill the land of Gilead in southern Lebanon? But if we make Assyria symbolic of Russia, you have a couple of million Jews in Russia. Well, who's Egypt? You say, well, the world. Yes, but what world? The Christian world. Where do you have your majority of Jews in the Christian world? Right here in the United States. And they will be going back too. And they will fill the East Bank, Gilead, and southern Lebanon. Isaiah 27. Verse 6 speaks of Israel, Jacob taking root, and Israel shall blossom in blood and fill the face of the world with fruit. A beautiful picture of Israel being the blessed nation in the kingdom. And then, like many Old Testament prophecies, it gives you a final scene, the climactic scene, and then the following verses show the process by which that climactic scene is reached. And then we pass down in this process, it goes through the double and all. We pass down to verse 13, and it shall come to pass in that day that the great trumpet shall be blown, and they shall come which are ready to perish in the land of Assyria, and the outcast in the land of Egypt, and shall worship the Lord at the holy mountain of Jerusalem. Okay, I should have started verse 12. And it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall beat off from the channel, and the word channel there is branches, shall beat off from the branches of the olive by the river unto the stream of Egypt. And ye shall be gathered one by one, O ye children of Israel. Remember in Zechariah 10, there was a river and a sea that was smitten that the Jews could cross over into the promised land. Just as in the type, and the type of the present regathering is the exodus from Egypt. And this is brought to our attention in Ezekiel, the 20th chapter. The Lord says that which cometh into your mind shall not be, that you say we shall be the people of the land to worship a wood and stubble. With the mighty hand and with a stretched out arm, I will gather you out of the nations into the wilderness, as I gathered your fathers into the wilderness of Egypt. And there I'll plead with you face to face, as I pleaded with them in the wilderness of Egypt. So the parallel, the current regathering from the nations of the world is the antitype of the exodus from Egypt. And just as that exodus, they had to cross miraculously over a sea and a river, so an antitype, that sea and river, are symbolic of hindrances that have prevented the immigration of Jews from Russia, Assyria, and Egypt, Western Christendom. What was that hindrance. In Russia, the hindrance was communism. The communists would not let the Jews leave. Now in Isaiah 27, it speaks of a gathering one by one by the river. And then the Jubilee trumpet sounds. And then there's a massive exodus from Assyria and Egypt. Before the fall of communism, the Jews that got out of Russia were one by one, a trickle. And there's other scriptures. Jeremiah 3 speaks of the a family of one, a family of two, or one, and then a family of two or three would be gathered from the north. There was a trickle gathering for a time. But then there was the blowing of the great trumpet in Russia, and what happened? People marched in their demand for freedom. Communism fell. The Soviet Union disintegrated. That was a tremendous blast of the Jubilee trumpet. And as a result of that, what happened? The Jews were free to leave Russia. And over 6,000 have come to Israel already. Okay, Isaiah 14. In I guess it's Isaiah 11. Sorry about that. Verse 11 speaks of them being regathered the second time. Verse 14, in connection with that regathering, he says, "But they, after the regathered, they, Israel, shall fly upon the shoulders of the Philistines toward the west. They shall spoil them of the east. They shall lay their hand upon Edom and Moab, and the children of Ammon shall obey them. And the Lord shall utterly destroy the tongue of the Egyptian sea, and he, with the mighty wind shall he shake his hand over the river, and shall smite it in seven streams, and make men go over dry shod. And there shall be a highway from the remnant for the remnant of his people that shall be left in Assyria, like as what? Like as Israel in the day that Israel came up out of the land of Egypt." Again, the antitype of that exodus from Egypt is this current regathering. "And they pass through the sea, and they pass through a river." Some of your modern translations will say the Euphrates instead of the river. That is not a translation. That's an interpretation. The Hebrew word there is river. It does not designate the name of a river. And we've said what we felt the river and the sea represent before. But before this smiting, there's going to be a war. We feel that the exodus from Russia isn't complete. It's down to a trickle again. There's going to be a war, and who's going to be involved? Israel shall fly upon the shoulders of the Philistines. Where do the Philistines occupy? Gaza. And then they shall go to the west, east, and they shall lay their hands upon Edom and Moab, and the children of Ammon shall obey them. So, on our map again, map number 7. Moab, Ammon, and Edom shall obey Israel in a war or with the Arabs, these with Jordan. And then the exodus from Russia will pick up again, and there will be like a highway from Assyria or Russia to Israel. It will be such a massive exodus. Okay, we want to close with the Zephaniah, the second chapter. Beginning with verse 4. "For Gaza shall be forsaken, and Ashkelon a desolation, and they shall drive out Ashdod at the noonday, and Ekron shall be rooted up. Woe unto the inhabitants of the seacoast, the nation of..." Well, it goes on. "The word of the Lord is against you, O Canaan, the land of the Philistines. I will even destroy thee, and there shall be no more inhabitants. And the seacoast shall be for dwellings, and the cottages, and for shepherds, and for the folds of flock. And the remnant of Israel will dwell there." Okay, it speaks of Gaza, and the war against Gaza and Ashkelon shall be desolate. Well, actually, the Philistines of old occupied Gaza, Ashkelon, and Ashdod, but we feel there might be a further thought here, that in a future war with the Arabs, that the Gaza will be an independent Arab state. And Israel will deal with Gaza, the state of Gaza, the Palestinian state of Gaza, last, because they're less of a threat, and they will take on Jordan, where Moab and Ammon and Ammon and Edom are. And after they defeat Jordan, then they'll go back down to Gaza, and by this time, the Palestinians will have made inroads into